ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson
one
is
making rise.
It's one nation.
This is the unlikely story of one nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The making of one nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Good morning, everyone.
G'day.
So lovely to be back. Everyone happy to see Brian Brown? Yeah. Brian Brown is an iconic Australian actor. He's been on our screens for nearly 50 years in films like Breaking Morant, Cocktail and Two Hands, and on TV shows like The Thornbirds and Boy Swallows Universe. He's always had a way with words, and these days, Brian Brown is a writer. He's with me, Claire Nichols, today on The Book Show. The Book Show is where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction writers. Later, Angela O'Keefe will be here to tell you about her book, which is narrated by a book. It'll make sense, I promise. But first, Brian Brown. In 2021, he published his first book of crime-centric short stories called Sweet Jimmy. And since then, there's been two novels, including his latest, The Hidden. Brian, well, he put on a show for me and a very enthusiastic audience at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. Brian, how's the trip been so far?
Oh, bloody good. I flew down yesterday morning. I got the 7:15 from Sydney and I looked at the thing and it said 5.5 hours or whatever, and I thought, oh, right, that's a fairly long while. However, I'd got a book at the Sorrento Festival, a lady on schizophrenia, which I went, that's pretty interesting. So I read that for about an hour and a half, and then I thought, you've got your computer, mate, and you've started another story. There's no distraction here. You can't get out and go to the coffee shop. You've actually got the opportunity to actually sit down and write something. So I actually fiddled away for another couple of hours. Next minute, they said, you're going to land. And then this really lovely bloke called Dave picked me up, and we chatted all the way down. And then I get the best bed I've ever slept in. I'm taking it home. And so I haven't got any complaints. I can't whinge about a bloody thing.
Riding on a plane, is that a good environment to
write? Could be a song, isn't it? I'm riding on a jet plane.
Is it a good space to work?
Yeah, I found it. I was actually pleased with myself that I did it because it was a good spot. I find it very easy to be distracted. In writing, you've got to sit down and find a time to write. And for myself, the difference for me is I've spent all my life as an actor or producer and doing film and television, telling stories. But I've spent all my life doing that, and I know the disciplines for it, and I've earned my living that way. Writing, I'm not a 35-year-old banking on having a writing career. So writing is more of a joy and an opportunity to be imaginative. And so, you know, I go, well, do I want to be imaginative today or not, you know? And so I don't have that discipline. And sometimes I've got to go, mate, Alan and Unwin have said, you promised them a book. Will you sit down for 3 days and write something? So the discipline's hard. So being on the plane, I went, this is a good chance to do something, you know.
How does being an actor make you a better writer?
Well, of course, I don't know if it does, but what I've been doing for 50 years is telling stories. You know, lots and lots of stories, either as an actor where someone presents a script and they would like me to play a character in it, and I read the script and I go, do I like this story? Do I want to be associated with this story? Then I look at the character and I go, okay, can I play that character? Can I deliver a character that fits this story in all the way? So I'm basically interpreting what someone else has laid down. As a writer, once again, I'm involved with telling stories, but I own the bloody thing. It's completely me. I make up the character, I make up the story, I make up everything about it. And that's a very different thing to interpreting. And it's a joy. It's a real joy to be I'm amazed at this imagination that we all have. It's extraordinary when we let it loose It's fun to let things run loose and tell stories.
And being an actor, you know, you work so much in dialogue. One thing I really like about your writing is the dialogue. You can hear that Australian vernacular in the way people talk. Are you reading out loud to yourself as you write?
No. No, I have no idea when I sit down what I'm going to do because I don't know what the story's going to be. I mean, there's two types of writers, as you probably know. There's those people who just write the story as it's coming to them, and those that plot it out and go, okay, this is where I want to go to and that's what it is. And then the ones that just tell the story and then some way have to try and make it come together at the end. I'm of that type where I sit down and I go, okay, Jimmy, who's Jimmy? And let's go, Jimmy. Where do you want to go? And Jimmy just wanders on. And I'm just writing down where Jimmy's going. And at the end of 2 hours or something, I mean, I sit there and I go, Brian, where did that come from? Where did that come from? I had no idea 2 hours before that that was going to be there. And I think that comes back to this, our imagination, the opportunity to be imaginative, which being in the arts allows you to do. Well, you have to be, you know. You haven't got someone saying, sit down here in front of the computer and I want you to give me that at the end of the day. You've got yourself sitting down going, what do I want to say today? And it's the same with acting. You know, like I get given a character to play, but when they say action, I have no idea how I'm going to play it, but I know who the character is. And when they say action, I just start talking.
But you could... it could be not right, right? Like
There is no right or wrong.
I get anxious when I hear from people who are pantsers, not plotters, right? Because I think, sure, here's Jimmy, where's he going to go? But you could spend 2 hours going down the wrong path, right? And then
no, it's not the wrong path. It's not the wrong path. You're going down there, but then the creative part is, how do I make that fit amongst this one that's gone down there? So it's not wrong. It's just... the fun of it is going on that journey with the characters, and then the creative part is how do I bring them together where they all are part of the story?
And that must be the most satisfying feeling when you figure it out.
Well, you just realise you're brilliant.
I'm really interested to know how you fit writing into your life because... you know, this isn't the job after acting. You're still busy acting, producing. You're still very busy in that world. So does writing come when there's a break between gigs or are you fitting this in day to day?
Well, as an actor, you don't have to worry about breaks. You know, they're there. I have to admit, it's part of the reason why I became an actor. I never wanted to work. I left school and I thought, Jesus, I'm not going to get a gig as good as school again, am I? Like 4 months holiday a year, mates to play with. You knew what the teachers wanted, so you just gave it to them. That was a really good gig, school, and suddenly it's over and you've got to do something. So I think I was, you know, in the back of my mind was like, where's big school?
Lots of holidays. Give the directors what they want and play with your mates.
Look, I had a very lucky thing happen to me in terms of all that when I was young. When I left school, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. But I was very good at mathematics, and then my mother found out about a thing called you could be an actuary, which is a mathematician area in finance and all that. And so you couldn't do it at university. You had to do it by correspondence from London. And the AMP Society, big insurance company, they gave you scholarships and you'd work there and you'd study there. And so I went there to study. I mean, as soon as I walked in the door, I knew that wasn't where I was going to end up all my life. But I did enjoy being paid money, the social activities, meeting lots of people. I enjoyed all that sort of stuff. After about 4 years, though, I looked out the window one day a couple of times and I used to see these blokes arrive in these really sharp cars and sharp suits. And I said to someone, who are they? And they said, they're the salesmen. I went, oh, well, I want to be a salesman. So I told the boss I didn't want to be an actuary anymore. I'm going to be a salesman. So I became a salesman. It was during that period that I came across amateur theatre. I'll tell you about that later. But the thing that I got as a salesman was like, when you're selling, it ends up being a statistic that you are. To earn the money you want to make, you might have to sell 3 policies. To sell those 3, your statistic is you've got to get in front of 10 people. Mm-hmm. To get in front of 10 people, you've got to ring 50. So they're your statistics. And then basically you start to realise it's a dead set statistic with you. So my thing was always like, I'd go out to sell a policy. I mightn't get one for the first seven, but then I'd get 8, 9, and 10. So when I went into this game called acting, where you have, you know, you go up for auditions and you don't get them, I'd learnt to embrace the no's because the yes is out there, you know. And so that's what I was always, it's one thing I'm so glad I learnt as a salesman was like, embrace the no's because the yes is there. And that, luckily that was, so when I miss out on an audition for something, I'd say, beauty, the next one will be the one or the one after or whatever.
Do you still miss out on auditions now?
I haven't auditioned for a long time.
Yeah. It's all yeses these days. You hinted earlier at falling in love with amateur theatre while you were an actuary and a salesman. Tell us how you found your way to amateur theatre.
I just finished being an actor and was about to be a salesman. And those big companies like the AMP and the big banks and all that, in those days, the people worked there for 40 years. They'd meet their partner there, they'd get their mortgage there, they'd retire from there. And so those big companies had to look after their staff, and they'd have clubs. They'd have the film club or the car club or the dancing club. They'd have these different clubs that people would go to, and they had to make sure they looked after their staff. The AMP Society had a drama club. And they sent a form around one day saying that they were going to do an end-of-the-year review, which would be sending up the bosses and all that, the people who'd written stuff, and anyone that wanted to audition to come up after work this day. So I said to a mate who was a bit of a larrikin, and I said, we ought to go up there because there's got to be girls we haven't met yet. So we go up there and they hand me a piece of paper, and him a piece of paper, and they say, we're going to get you, have a look at this, and then we'll get you to read opposite someone. Well, my mate went, I'm not for this, and he ducked out. And I went, well, okay. So they then asked me after about half an hour to read it opposite someone else. And at the end of that, they then said, look, we'd like you to join the company if you want to do it. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do it. And they said, all right, rehearsal starts tomorrow afternoon after work. So I went home. Now, I always liked going to work. You know, I like the journey and the train. I like the people I met in the work, I liked it and everything. But I woke up that morning and I couldn't wait to go to work because I was going to do this thing called rehearsals that I didn't have a clue what that was, but I knew I wanted to be there. So I did the show, and at the end of it, I'd really enjoyed it. But that looked like that was going to be the end of it. And then a friend of mine said, you know, why don't you join an amateur theatre? And there was one in the middle of Sydney called the Genesian Theatre. And they had an entree to it, and they said, go down there and ask for this bloke. So I went down and joined that theatre, and for the next 4 years, I spent a lot of time at that theatre because as a salesman, as anyone here knows, no one knows where the hell you are as long as you get your figures in on the Friday, right? So I was down there and been involved backstage or doing the odd play or rehearsing or whatever, but it was I'd given up playing rugby league on a weekend to be doing shows there. So it became really something, and I guess I was subconsciously aware that I was giving up a lot of things that I really enjoyed to do this, and happily doing so. Anyway, I did that for 4 years, and I then went, all right, you know, you're 25 now, mate. You got to stop kidding yourself or give it a real go or just get on with a career in some way. So I sold my car, I bought a ticket to England, and I went off to England knocking on doors telling people I was an actor.
That suggests a great confidence in yourself. Like, did you know you had it?
No, I knew that I wanted to be there.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that I'll never get over is I was brought up by a single parent mother. She brought my sister and myself up. She didn't have any family. Her parents had died by the time she was 16. She had no brothers and sisters. My father and his side of the family, I never knew. Well, I knew, but I didn't really know at all. Met him about 10 times. But my mother devoted herself to my sister and I. So we were incredibly secure. Mm. And like when I went to be an actuary, I know Mum was really happy. Okay, he's got a profession. He's going to be all right. And then I go, I'm going to be a salesman. I think the only thing she said there was, your father was a salesman. But that's all. She didn't go, oh, God, no, darling, you know, please, you've got to. It was like, okay, you're getting on with that. And then I was doing very well as a salesman. And then I say, Mum, I'm going to England to be an actor. Like, it must have been a punch in the guts. But she said, she never said, oh, that's stupid, don't do that. It was like, okay, that's what you're going to do. Luckily, it worked out all right. And also, growing up in the suburbs, you know, it's adventurous. You're in houses, in the roof of houses that are being built, having gang meetings at 7 years of age with other seven-year-olds, and you're in the swamps and you're climbing trees and you're running around. So there's a sense of adventure, of like being in the moment. Oh, this is what I want to do. Mm. And you do it. So there's that sense of going on. I think sort of going, oh, no, I'm going to England to be an actor, was no different to saying, oh, I'm going to Jerry's place for a game of cricket.
And you get to England, you start knocking on doors. You know the stats that if you knock on enough doors, something's going to come good.
That's it in the back of my mind. I go to England and I knew I had to get in the theatre. I knew no one. But on the way to England, I stopped in Greece. I went to an island called Mykonos. And when you arrive in Mykonos, a lady's usually there that's selling you a bed for the night, you know. And there was a lady there and she had seven beds in her house. And me and my mate said, yeah, okay, for a dollar a night, we'd have the bed. And there was a couple of young Irish guys that had just become doctors that were there. But there was also a young boy from the Chelsea Public Housing. And he said, what are you going to England for? I said, I want to be an actor in the theatre. He said, my father's in the theatre. And I thought, ding, right. Really, what's he do? He said, he's a fireman. Right? Now, in England, in the big theatres in London, they have these fire screens that come down at an interval, big solid screens, right? And they have a fireman is in every theatre. And this bloke was a chief fireman at one of the theatres. Now, I knew I had to get in the theatre. I didn't care whether it was cleaning toilets or whatever. I had to get in that place because from there other things could happen. Not if I was working in the butcher's shop. It wasn't going to... So I had to get in that area. So I looked up the bloke. And when I went to London, his father sent me to the chief fireman. The chief fireman signed a form and I was given cards allowing me to work. And I was that night I was pushing scenery at a place called the Victoria Palace.
Wow.
And, of course, once I was in there, then I'd hear someone else say, oh, look, there was a young actor that was there and he was saying, you've got to get out into the provinces. You can't work in London. That's going to be too hard. Get out. So I'd write to the provinces and I eventually ended up in the provinces in the north of England, a place called Billingham near Stockton-on-Tees. And I did theatre and education for 6 months. And then I came down to London and... Oh, I may as well tell you the story. So... I come down to London and there's a paper called The Stage, and in it has the different jobs that are available in the theatre. There was a company called The Actors Company at that time with Ian McKellen, that a lot of people will have heard of, was one of the actors in it. And it was called The Actors Company. And they were going on a tour of the United States to all the colleges, and they were going to do a couple of plays. And they were looking for someone that would do backstage and play some of the smaller parts. So I wrote a letter and sent a photograph saying, could I audition? And I got a reply saying, yes, you can audition. So I came in and I did a piece for them. I went home that night and I got a phone call from one of the actresses that was part of choosing you. And she said, look, Brian, we all like what you did, but the part that we got is not right for you. And I was like, okay. And she said, however, my sister is the casting director for the National Theatre of Great Britain at the Old Vic under Peter Hall, who's just taken over from Sir Laurence Olivier. And she said, and they get it forming a new company. Would you like to audition? I said, bloody oath. So I got in touch with her sister. She asked me to do something in front of her. Then she said, well, go home and we'll see what happens. She rings me that night and she said, all right, tomorrow you're going to audition for Peter Hall. Now, Peter Hall was this impresario who at 25 ran the Royal Shakespeare Company.
Wow.
And had now been given taking over the National Theatre from Sir Laurence Olivier. You know, a very, very powerful and significant figure in the theatre. And that's who I was going. She said, tomorrow you're auditioning in front of Peter Hall. And I was thinking, okay, all right, well, I got the piece that I can do. And she said, oh, and by the way, you've got to sing a song.
Are you a singer?
No. You've got to sing a song. And I'm thinking, God, you know, I go, all right. Now, when I was pushing scenery backstage, there was a young man there who was studying to be an opera singer. And sometimes we'd go down to the Royal Albert Hall where he would get a piano and he would practice. And he used to say to me, come on, let's go over a couple of songs here because you might get asked to audition. So he had me doing Bridge Over Troubled Waters and When the Red, Red Robin Comes Bob, Bob, Bobbing Along. So when she says, have you got a song? I go, yeah. So the next day I go down to the old Vic and I'm in the wings waiting for my turn. There's a bloke on before me doing his bit and then he sings his song and it's an aria. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, that's what they mean by a song. So it's my turn and Gillian Diamond comes out and he goes, Peter, this is Brian. He's going to do this part from Love's Labour's Lost. And I do that, and Peter goes, yeah, I go, just you're racing ahead of the text, just do it again. So I do it again, he goes, right, yeah. And then they've got the musical director of the National Theatre is there. And so then Gillian says, and Peter says, has Brian got a song? And Gillian says, yes, Peter, he's got When the Red, Red Robin Comes. Bob, Bob, Bob. So I stand up in front of him, and I do it like this. I go, When the Red, Red Robin Comes Bob, 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 and along, along, they'll be no. That's how I did it. Peter Hall smiles. I don't think you've ever seen anything like it. The musical director goes, okay, do this. Ah, and I go, ah, and he goes this, he gets to go, and they go, all right. So I come off and Gillian says, go home. And so that night she rings me and she says, we're offering you a year's contract at the National Theatre.
Incredible.
And I did it.
Were you a big reader growing up?
No, I wasn't. I do remember golden books that Mum used to have in her. And I loved them at 30. But I don't remember, like, Mum was busy. Mum was, you know, if she wasn't playing piano at ballet class or cleaning houses or cooking for us or cleaning, well, you know, and then one lady bringing up two kids, you know, there wasn't a lot of time, but we did have golden books around. But I don't remember being fascinated by them or anything. But I do remember at school, the subject I hated most was English. And I find it strange that my whole life's been involved with the English language. But I hated it because I couldn't connect. The books we had to read, like Great Expectations or something, had nothing to do with my life. Poetry was like, give us a break. And Shakespeare, you know, Romeo, Romeo, wherefore art thou? Why didn't you say you want to come down the lane for a kiss and a cuddle? But so it didn't connect at all. But on the way to England, which I knew was going to be a long journey, I thought maybe I should buy a book. And there was this book called Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee by Dee Brown, a history of the American Indian and what happened as they travelled west making America. And I read that book during the course of flight over and travelling through Europe in a van at the time, and I was fascinated by it. And it opened my mind to things that I hadn't ever had to consider or think about. And that started me reading, and I think that continued, and I became a big reader and read all sorts of stuff.
When you started writing, and the first book was Sweet Jimmy, the book of short stories, was it always going to be crime fiction, or is that just what came out?
No, I thought it was romance. And there's a bit in there.
Yeah.
I hadn't really read crime fiction until maybe 15 years ago when my sister introduced me to it. And so once again, it's a stumble. I was watching television one night and CNN was on and there was a group of about eight people there, men and women, about my age. This was in Hong Kong and they'd all just been released from prison. And the judges said to them, you're not drug mules, you're stupid. And they'd all been caught carrying things through that they didn't know they were carrying because they hadn't gotten in with romance or whatever, and they'd all got caught. And I was looking at that and I thought, if I was one of those blokes, I'd have to know who's done this to me. Mm. And then I went, not a bad idea for a series, Brian. So I started to write that bloke's story. And Jenny Byrne, who's a friend of mine, who's a journalist.
Jennifer Byrne,
She knew I was doing that. Something had come up and she said, can I read it? And so I gave it to her to read. And she said, it's good. I really like how you write. Have you got any others? And I went, no, I don't really, no. She said, I think if you have stuff like that, we could get it published. And, of course, as soon as someone tells you that, you know, it's, no, I haven't got any stories, but I'm driving down the car and the little bee's buzzing in there. And I was driving down one day and I went, what if Sam Neill was a thief? Well, he'd be useless, I'll tell you that. But I had the thing, Sam the thief. Who is Sam and what has he stolen? And off I ran. Well, the long and short of it was I ended up with 7 short stories, and Alan and Unwin read them and said they'd like to publish them, and that was off it ran.
And here we are now, 2 novels later. This has been such a blast. Can you please thank Brian Brown?
Thank you.
Brian Brown's latest novel is called The Hidden, and he was with me on Wurundjeri Land at the Margaret River Readers and Writers Festival. On ABC Radio National, you're listening to The Book Show with me, Claire Nichols. And the next novel I have for you starts at a book launch. Although, I don't know if I've ever imagined a book launch from the perspective of the book itself.
In the beginning, the sky was yellow and did not change for years on end. I became me in that yellowness. At my launch, I was one of 100 copies, some stacked on a table beside a small credit card terminal, others waiting in boxes on the floor. Booksellers are nothing if not optimistic. I was signed by my author, whom you might assume I was close to, given that she was with me all through the yellow years. But here is a little known fact about authors. They lay themselves down in the middle of the road, quite prepared to be run over by a car or picked apart by birds, all for the sake of a book. But at the last moment, when they must surely be flattened or picked apart, they stand and walk away, and the book is left alone. The room where the launch took place was small and crowded. People chatted, a few laughed raucously. It was hot and everyone's face shone. My author sat at a table before which a queue formed. I was no longer close to her, as I have said. After finishing me, she turned her back on me. Yet, as her hand rested on my inside cover as she wrote in me, I knew that I would always be of at hand. To Isabel, she wrote.
That's Angela O'Keefe reading The Story of a Book from the opening pages of her novel Phantom Days. Angela is an Australian writer. She was longlisted for the Miles Franklin in 2024 for her second novel, The Sitter, and now she's back with this book about a book. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Claire.
Is it really true? Do authors turn their back on books when they're finished with them?
Yeah, in a way, I think it's necessary. You kind of pushed out, really, of the story. I mean, you're not in the magic of it anymore. But, of course, you can reread it and remember how it might have felt. But, yeah, you're out.
So what's your relationship with Phantom Days right now? Because it's finished, it's published, but you're still talking about it a lot at this point.
Well, it's not the same as being in it. And I guess, in a way, I can see things about it that I couldn't while I was writing it. So that's interesting.
It's such an unusual thing to imagine what it must like to be a book, Angela O'Keefe. When did you start thinking about this?
So I guess it was in Trump's first time as president, and there were book bans in certain states. And, you know, I did start thinking about what it might feel like from the perspective of those books. Suddenly they're sort of wiped, you know. I started to think about the power of books, the power of words, stories, and also the impotence of stories. So that all that sort of was underlying my time of working on this book.
That's really fascinating to hear about that context, because those kind of big world politics that inspired this book haven't made their way into the novel. This is a very domestic, a very individual story about one woman who buys one book. I am interested to know, though, once you think, okay, I'm going to write chapters from the perspective of a book, how do you do that? What rules do you set for yourself? How do you decide what a book can see and think and feel?
Well, the rules had to sort of evolve, but I think the main thing was that I was getting the voice right. The book is not all powerful, you know, and that was necessary. There needed to be limits, and all, you know, I had to ask myself, what does a book want more than anything? And a book wants to be read.
Yeah.
You know, a story wants to be received.
This is fascinating. I think it's probably making us all feel terrible about all the books left on our bedside tables that we haven't got to, Angela.
Full of longing.
Yeah, they're missing us. They're missing us. But I did find this so kind of delicious, because, of course, I talk to authors about this all the time, the fact that there's not just a relationship between you, the author, and the story. There's then the next relationship between the reader and the story. So in a way, we bring that story to life. We have a role as the reader too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, that's what I find so exciting, is that when I'm writing, I'm also the reader. You know, I'm making space for the reader to have an experience. And that's exciting, because you can't really predict what that experience is going to be.
And our reader in this book is Isabel. She buys this book, as we heard in that opening scene. Who is Isabel?
Isabel's a young woman, I guess in her early 30s, who has just started a relationship with a man called Lewis, and he's gone to London for work, and he's asked her to come and spend a week with him. So she's kind of in love with him, and she just happens to see a light on in a bookshop, and she's drawn in by the light, really. She just goes in, and she doesn't know who the author is. Anyway, she buys the book, gets it signed, and goes to London. And in London, we get quite a bit of the story through the book. So it's what the book is observing of Isabel and Lewis.
But I should make it clear for listeners that not every chapter in this book is from the perspective of this book. Was that just a necessity for storytelling?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, it's not that I sort of think in those terms. It's more that, well, I want to know about Isabel and what's going on inside her, and the book can't tell me that.
Hasn't sitting on a shelf waiting to be read.
And it's not all powerful and all seeing, you know. And the same with Isabel's mother, Maggie.
Now, the book is called Phantom Days, Angela O'Keefe, and not long after Isabel gets back from the UK, she thinks she's pregnant, but this is a phantom pregnancy. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about this phenomenon?
Well, I'll tell you how I came to write about it. And that was my friend told me a story many years ago about how she'd once been at a party in Denmark, and she met a woman who was pregnant with a phantom child. And I said to my friend, "What happened to her?" And she said, "I don't know. I never saw her again." And that little story, with no ending, or with a question mark ending, kind of stayed with me. And I kind of knew I'd write about it one day. I just find it fascinating that this can happen to someone.
Because it's like the body believes that it's pregnant, right?
Yes. And with medical imaging, it's much less common now. I mean, it was never common, but it's more rare now. But Isabel does have ultrasounds, and she still thinks she doesn't think she's pregnant with a child. She knows she's not, but she's still showing the symptoms of pregnancy.
And you know, coming back to this idea of our novel being partly narrated by a book, of course, I started thinking about that old cliche that authors pull out, that often it's like their books are their babies, right? There's kind of a little overlap happening here.
A little bit, yes. With the fandom pregnancy, I kind of, as I was going along with it, because Isabel sees it as a light inside her, and I was thinking, what does this actually represent to me as a writer? You know, why am I writing about this? And to me, it's representing something that you produce, but it's nothing. And it's kind of anti-capitalist in that way. You know, I just find, I mean, I saw this performance piece, and I don't know the artist, but he kicked around a big block of ice all around a city.
Okay.
Until it melted and there was nothing there. And, you know, this is similar. It's something, but it's nothing. And it means something. Sometimes it means something to produce nothing.
You also mentioned Isabel's mum, Maggie. Maggie is recovering from breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was then thinking about things like changes in the body, about growth, about mutation. I'm curious to know, Angela O'Keefe, if all these links between cancer and between pregnancy and about books, were these all clear to you when you started writing this book, or did they reveal themselves to you?
They very much revealed themselves. I knew about the phantom pregnancy at the start, and I knew that about the book. As far as Maggie's situation goes, I actually had breast cancer while I was writing the book.
Wow.
And, you know, I was in chemo and I stopped writing, but I was thinking about the novel a lot. And I thought to myself, thank God I don't have to write about this experience, yeah. You know. And then one day I just realized, oh, this actually belongs to Maggie, you know. This is how kind some writers can be. We can give a very difficult experience to our, gift it to our character. But it really belonged to the book, because I underwent that same operation where, you know, my tummy fat basically is taken out and new breasts are formed from it, which I found crazy.
Yeah.
And I'd never actually read much about that. I'd never read anyone's experience of that. And I thought, well, let's see how it goes with Maggie. And I think it works.
I do think it works too. I found it interesting to say you realised that that belonged to Maggie, even though you hadn't necessarily wanted to write about it.
Hmm.
In writing it down, you know, you've just very recently gone through this ordeal. What does that do for you? Does it help you look at your cancer experience in a different way?
I found it fun.
Really?
Wow. I didn't find the experience fun, but I found it was like being able to see myself, I guess, in a character, or see a character that had aspects of myself, and just sort of walk around and circle my own experience, but in her world. So, yeah, I found it fascinating and quite satisfying.
I'm so pleased to hear it. I should also say that, you know, this book, Phantom Days, it packs a punch, and it does it all in 164 pages, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Angela O'Keefe, can you make a case for short novels?
Well, earlier I was speaking about making room for the reader, and I think that a short novel can do that very well. I mean, not all of them do, but, you know, this might sound like an easy answer, but when I was a child, I was in a family of 10 children.
Wow.
And I was one of the youngest. And I remember when I was about 12, I used to talk endlessly about my dreams, you know, my nighttime dreams, and tell these long, convoluted stories. And I remember my sister saying to me one day, "You need to learn to summarize." And, you know, I do think that was a moment where I realized, yeah, you've got to really be on the ball and hold your audience And a lot of books I read, to be honest, I feel like there's filler in them.
Mm.
And I'm just sort of waiting to, you know, I'm wading through parts of them. I'm not sure why they're that long, but a lot of longer books don't need to be as long as they are.
Well, I think you do so much in this book with so few pages. It really is a marvel. And listeners, you'll have to read it, otherwise it will get sad. It's called Phantom Days. It's published by UQP. Angela O'Keefe, it's been great to meet you today.
Thank you so much, Claire.
You've been listening to The Book Show, where today I spoke to Brian Brown and Angela O'Keefe. Brian's latest book is The Hidden and Angela's is Phantom Days. The Book Show is produced by Sarah Lestrange. Sarah and I make the program on Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar land.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.